You're listening to the Tan Talk Radio Network.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh. For you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul.
Well, good morning. Tony Bennett. On this Valentine's Day, we thought we'd give you a little Tony Bennett. He's in town. He's over at the Ruth Eckert Hall, I believe. I may be wrong about exactly where he is, but I think he's in town. I did see a review on him. The gentleman, I believe, is 91 years old, and he is still going strong. I may be wrong on the age, too, but I know he's hovering around that age. Anyway, good morning and welcome to Freedom Works, the Paul Molloy Show, Tampa Bay's libertarian radio voice. I am Paul Molloy. It is Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. Hey, have you got your honey a gift yet? You're getting a fair warning right now about it. Anyway, thanks for being with us. And in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Mark Thornton. Mark Thornton is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And the topic is the war on drugs. Is it being won? Is it being lost? Should it be even fought at all? We're also going to discuss a little later whether the Obama healthcare rollout numbers for signups are accurate or are they purposely being manipulated. And in our FreedomWorks Ultimate Top 10, the 10 best colleges in America. So stay tuned for that as well. FreedomWorks, we come to you 3 days a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 12 noon Eastern Time, here on the Tan Talk Radio Network. We are here doing this to promote the libertarian perspective. The very simple idea that the more freedom you have, the happier, the more productive, better off you're going to be. You know, personal liberty, as you were promised in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution as well. Liberty that Washington, in many ways, has been slowly pulling away from you. And maybe in more recent years, rather quickly pulling away from you. Anyway, glad you're with us. And we would love to have you call in with your thoughts and questions. Our toll-free number is 866-826-1340, 866-826-1340. And if you'd like to use our local number, it is 727-441-3000. Also, you can access more about our show, what we're all about, by going to our website, which is thefreedomworks.com, thefreedomworks.com. Yeah, I know it sounds a little awkward, but freedomworks.com was already grabbed, so the had to be added. thefreedomworks.com. Well, it's Valentine's Day, and comes around once a year, doesn't it? Right around this time, I think so. So don't forget, you know, you get out there and get something for that special person in your life. St. Valentine. I wonder if the poor guy ever knew he was going to be the model for all the flowers and candy and gifts that come on his birthday. Anyway, we're going to be talking, as I said, in just a few minutes with Mark Thornton. But before that, I want to talk a little bit about whether or not those numbers you are hearing about Obamacare, which are coming from the government, are being inflated or are accurate. The Obama administration has a rather rosy scenario saying that about 3.3 million consumers have signed up for Obamacare, for the Affordable Care Act. But some top insurance industry executives estimate that somewhere in the range of 10 to 25% of all the enrollees have not yet paid anything. You see, it's one thing to go into the website and enroll, but until you pay it, are you really enrolled? Well, apparently, federal government thinks you are, but how many of those people are going to end up paying it? And how many of all of those that even want to pay it are going to get screwed up along the way in so doing. So, here's one senior industry exec. He said the numbers are not as high as the 3.3 million figure. It's lower. The numbers are inflated. The question is how much? Now, I'm reading from a Fox News story, but industry officials have told Fox News that some insurance companies are privately saying that up to 30% of enrollees have not paid, while other companies believe a higher percentage of customers have taken care of their premiums. This source suggested that it averages out to roughly 10 to 25% of enrollees not yet paying into the system, and thus those individuals do not really have insurance. Well, okay, so there's always going to be glitches that way, I'm sure. But the question is really, how many people will ultimately enroll in Obamacare? I mean, that's the real thing. I think, eventually they'll figure out a way to get the money from the enrollee to the enroller. But scenarios for not paying include people who went through the struggles of trying to get into the healthcare website and eventually decided it wasn't worth it to go through the final steps of paying, all the way to others who may simply not be able to afford the premiums, even though they'll sign up for it. Now, industry officials believe others have gone through the process of choosing a plan and simply have not gotten around to writing the check yet for it. But eventually they may make the payment to complete the process, and then it would wind up being a success story. Now, you would think the federal government would know how many people actually paid for it, you know, and then be honest about that and say, well, we've actually, you know, we've got, let's say, 3.3 million that signed up, but we've got 2.5 million that have actually paid. I mean, what's the difference? Be honest about it. You think you could do that. And, people would understand. Well, also, I wanted to talk a little bit about global warming. Because of the weather we're getting up in the, right now in the Northeast, it went whacking Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama as well. But here's an interesting thing from yesterday on CBS This Morning. The host of CBS This Morning, his name's Charlie Rose, and they started talking apparently about this year's harsh winter here in the States, North America. But the guest, his name is Michio Kaku, K-A-K-U, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Kaku or Kaku, a physics professor from New York City College. He says that our extreme cold weather is just another example of global warming. And, kind of an interesting twist. Now, this physics professor, Michio Kaku, not a climatologist, claimed that the wacky weather could get even wackier, and it's all because of global warming. He says what we're seeing is that the jet stream and the polar vortex are becoming unstable. Instability of historic proportions. He says we think it's because of the gradual heating up of the North Pole. He says the North Pole is melting. He says that excess heat generated by all this warm weather is destabilizing this gigantic bucket of cold air. So that's the irony, that heating could actually cause gigantic storms of historic proportions. And so Rose said to him, so this was all because of global warming. And Kaku went on to say that the weather instabilities that we are seeing are because of the erratic nature of the jet stream and the polar vortex. But Kaku said it's too late to change any of this. So, that's rather interesting scenario. I've also heard that the ice and glacier levels of both the North and South Pole have been getting larger. So I don't know what to believe anymore about the global warming or the global cooling. I know that used to be called global warming, and now they've changed it to climate change. Anyway, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the war on drugs with Mark Thornton of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. So we'll slide out with a little Tony Bennett. Be right back.
Heard they crowded the floor. Couldn't bear it without you. Don't get around much anymore.
Imus in the morning.
But the difference is between the celebrities and the regular fans.
Regular folks like us.
Yeah, what are you guys?
Regular folks like us.
Yeah, I pay a mortgage.
You haven't. You wouldn't know reality if they walked up and smacked you.
What does that mean? You were talking about.
I want to know what the regular person means.
You know what Deirdre tried to tell me one time?
That you can't. Ridiculous.
Yes, it is.
Here's what Deirdre thinks. She tried to tell me that you can't get a decent handbag for less than $5,000.
There you go. See?
The other day, I noticed that Michael Kors' stock went up. You know why?
No, but that's why fashion is great, because you can buy things that are fashionable at $20 and $5,000.
Why don't you try
the $20 and $500?
Why don't you try the $20 option then? All of the money my poor little son wins in the rodeo, he has to give to her so she can buy another dress.
Catch Imus in the Morning right here on the stations of the Tantalk Network.
Fight fans, the biggest MMA event in the history of Wesley Chapel takes place Saturday, February 15th, 6 p.m. at Freedom High School. Wesley Chapel Fight Night 5 features 10 amateur bouts and 6 female bouts. Tickets available and can be purchased online at AOLMMA.com or the Wesley Chapel Wing House. For VIP information, call 813-992-2886. Wesley Chapel Fight Night 5. Be there.
You're listening to the Tan Talk Radio Network.
But nevertheless, why stir up memories?
Been invited on dates.
I might have gone, but what for? It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore.
Hey, we're back. A little Tony Bennett for you on this Valentine's Day. Well, we are delighted to have Mark Thornton join us from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Before I bring Mark on, I want to just mention Richard Branson. I think this is the guy that had that airline. And he has an article in the Miami Herald. It was on Tuesday in the Miami Herald. He talks about the global war on drugs. He says that it has failed. He says that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are said to have cost the U.S. taxpayer over $4 trillion. And he says it's not ended any terrorism, and many would argue neither has either country found peace or security. But he says the so-called war on drugs is also a failed war. He says despite more than 40 years of prohibition, illicit drugs remain one of the most valuable industries in the world after food and oil. An industry entirely under the control of criminals. He says drugs are cheaper, more available than ever before. He says millions of people are in prison for drug offenses. And he just goes on to talk about how things are so bad because we try to prohibit drugs. Mark, is Richard Branson on the right track, do you think?
Paul, it's great to be on the show.
Yeah.
I think I couldn't agree more with Mr. Branson. It's everywhere you look, you see the drug war is a failure. And I think that more and more Americans are recognizing that the approach that we're taking, using police and courts and the military to try to stomp out drugs, not only doesn't it work, but it has repercussions that go well beyond the direct costs of the war on drugs, and it's really hurting families. It's hurting communities. It's a scourge to our health and our healthcare system, and it's just awful in every way. And everywhere you look, there's no real victory. I guess you could look at the case of marijuana and see some progress there. I think we've made a lot of ideological and political progress with marijuana, and also medical progress. I mean, we're finding out every day that cannabis and various components of cannabis are very good medical products and are can be serving us now in things like shrinking cancerous tumors and curing leukemia, certain types of leukemia. So there are some positive aspects, but it has nothing to do with the war on drugs. It's rolling back the war on drugs that's really the positive side of all this.
Well, I would tend to think that people are in agreement generally that slowly but surely other drugs are going to be legalized. Maybe marijuana will be the first one, and then others will follow. And surely you can't go around saying that alcohol and tobacco are legal and that's fine, but you can't allow other drugs to also be legal. They're just that's like an arbitrary selection. Alcohol and tobacco, certainly. How many people do they kill, you know? So I guess somebody could argue, though, look what it's done to other countries that have legalized most drugs. And I remember years ago, I don't know if it's true anymore, but Amsterdam was always pointed at. And so what would you say to people that say, well, look what happens when you legalize drugs in these countries? You get all these potheads wandering around and all of these people that are not living productive lives because they get into these drug habits. How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, it can be unsightly in certain instances. For example, in Switzerland, they legalized heroin in certain municipal parks, and it created, you know, where people were going, moving there, bums and so forth, heroin addicts, and it became unsightly. But if you look at Amsterdam, they legalized marijuana to a certain extent, and that created marijuana tourism, bringing a lot of people that the Dutch didn't really want there. But it also brought down marijuana use amongst Dutch teenagers. So you have to look at this in the broad spectrum of things. The more inclusive your liberalization laws are, the better the results. And for example, Portugal decriminalized all drug use in Portugal so that you couldn't just go, you know, smoking pot around in public, and you couldn't, you know, openly be using heroin and so forth. But basically, if they caught you as a consumer, they basically, you know, gave you a ticket and maybe encouraged you to seek some counseling or even required you to seek some counseling. But basically what the Portuguese have experienced over the last 10 years or so is declining drug abuse, declining drug addiction, declining spread of HIV through dirty needles, and much less drug-related crime. It's still illegal to sell drugs in Portugal, but basically they've made general improvements with respect to drug use and abuse as a result of decriminalizing and bringing these problems more to the surface. And so you're seeing other countries. Uruguay just voted to legalize for recreational purposes marijuana. European countries have relaxed some of their drug laws, and so it's happening. Mexico is considering legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing some other drugs. And so other people, you know, it's not just Americans. Other people have recognized that this approach to the war on drugs is not the right approach, and that you can reduce the cost to society, you can reduce the cost of government, and you can actually make inroads against the problems of drug use and drug abuse by making it more normal, by making it more legal, bringing it within a legal and social framework rather than an illegal underground setting. It's the worst of all possible worlds. You know, so I think that any step we can take in the direction of normalizing the environment for drugs actually brings us closer to the possibility of addressing the problems of drug use, drug abuse, drug addiction, and even things like overdoses and things of that nature. You know, we just experienced the loss of Philip Seymour Hoffman to a heroin overdose, where he got a bunch of very, very adulterated, very potent heroin supplies that also contained even included drugs that were even more dangerous and potent. And that's another thing. You know, as we try to stamp out marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, which are more or less the natural forms of recreational drugs, you know, chemist labs all over the globe are inventing new and dangerous substitutes. And so Breaking Bad is breaking out all over the world.
Yes, I can understand what you're saying. We're talking, by the way, with Mark Thornton, again, a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And first of all, how, by legalizing these drugs, why do you think usage has gone down in certain cases? Like you mentioned, I think Portugal, and did you say that marijuana use has gone down there? Why would that be if you're allowing people to use it more than before?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one we don't have a clear, direct answer for. What a lot of people think is that once you legalize some of these drugs, and drug use has not gone down tremendously in Portugal, but it has gone down, and I think it has something to do, and people think it has something to do with the fact that when you make something illegal, you draw attention to it, and you know, you hold it out as this risky, daredevilish type thing, and so that may account for the fact that by decriminalizing these things, it loses the luster of being, you know, bad and nasty and dangerous, which tends to attract young male adults. And also, I think there's a little bit going on here that once you legalize something and, you know, somebody gets caught with heroin and they get brought down to the police station, and, you know, they're given a fine or a ticket, and they may be required by a judge to seek counseling or to seek a drug addiction treatment or encouraged to do so. You know, what the Portuguese are experiencing is that more people are seeking counseling and addiction treatment over there. And so the numbers are improving, and it's not a big improvement. And it's not outright legalization either, but at least it's progress. And I think, you know, that's the thing that the war on drugs has taught us, is that not only haven't we made any progress with that approach, but things have only seemed to have gotten worse over time. And so this decriminalization, liberalization of these laws has at least pushed us in the direction of going in terms of positive improvements, you know, with less crime and less addiction and less overdoses. And so I think that the evidence at least suggests that this liberalization approach is taking us in the right direction. And it should encourage us and reduce the fear that society has of opening up to these problems in a social way rather than a police enforcement and military approach to these problems.
Do you think that children, just like with cigarettes and alcohol, should be not permitted to use these drugs until they reach a certain age?
Yes. And, the basic legal structure of Western civilization basically has laws built into it. You know, where you have minors, and then you have, you know, the age of consent, and you can't make legally valid contracts with minors. And so I think anybody who would be willing to sell any kind of dangerous products to minors would be subject to significant legal penalties for doing so. And so, you know, I can imagine a situation where it would be okay for a parent to buy their teenage son cigarettes or something like that, but it would still be illegal to make contracts, a selling contract with minors with any type of good, but in particular, any kind of dangerous good. Courts and juries would frown on that, especially if the minor experienced, you know, an emergency room visit or an overdose situation. So Western civilization has it built in to our general legal structure that, yes, I mean, you can't make legally valid contracts with minors, and that is especially the case with any kind of dangerous product. So that, you know, a 16-year-old can't go, for example, rent a rental car, even if they've got a license. And so I think that society would definitely shield minors from dangers associated with illegal or legal drugs.
You touched on Philip Seymour Hoffman and his getting some strange drugs into his system. And I think your connection was, well, it's not being regulated, and therefore you just you don't know what you're going to get. But are you saying that with the allowance of drugs that the government would then regulate it like tobacco? If it became legal, I mean, let's go to heroin or cocaine or some of the very potent drugs, won't you start seeing all of these different kinds of, newly created combinations of drugs? I mean, the sky might be the limit, right?
It might, Paul. I mean, you know, we never know what's going to happen in a free market. Usually it's always a positive thing, but we can't predict for certain. But what we have seen, and what my economic dissertation was on the topic of, why marijuana was becoming so potent. In the 1970s, the THC content of marijuana was 1%. Right now, they're getting readings that average close to 10%.
Wow.
And when I wrote my dissertation, it was like 5%. And so the more we've pushed in that direction, the more potent the products have become, and the more dangerous and variable they became over time, the more money we spent on it. So I would look back at alcohol prohibition, and what I found is that beer was very expensive and there was very hard to get. Wine was almost non-existent and was very hard to get, very expensive. And almost the entire market had shifted to whiskey, and very, you know, double potent whiskey and double potent bathtub gin.
Are we talking about the Depression years or what?
Where? In the alcohol prohibition, yes. 1920 to 1933.
Got it.
The alcohol got more and more potent over time, and it was also the potency or the percentage of alcohol increased, and it became more variable, and there was more pollutants in the products. And so what we've experienced in alcohol prohibition was that it got more potent, more variable, and more dangerous. And what we saw from the 70s to today is that marijuana became much more potent over time, and that as it became more costly, suppliers first turned to cocaine, then they turned to crack. Then heroin made its reappearance in large numbers, and then crystal meth got onto the scene as an inexpensive substitute. And now we've seen all these synthetic things coming in from China and Asia and Vietnam, all these chemical labs. They're changing the configuration of the molecules in order to make them at least temporarily legal. And they're getting into the underground economy here in the U.S., and they can easily flip these molecules now. And, the producers don't know what the products can do, and people show up with overdose situations at hospitals, and the doctors don't even – they can't determine what the chemical is because they've never seen it before, because it only came into existence within the last 30 to 90 days. And so – this kind of problem is really, really scary, and I think it's even scaring our law enforcement because of what they're seeing coming in to this country and what it's coming into the marketplace under these conditions. And it's really one of the reasons, you know, people have switched to try to get OxyContin and Vicodin and some of these prescription drugs is because they're legal and they're pure and they're pharmaceutical. But they're very addictive and very deadly. I mean, more people are dying now of the pharmaceutical products than are dying of the old heroin and cocaine. So, you know, if you really study what's going on in the underground economy in terms of illegal drugs. It's very, very scary. And, you know, the products that this heroin product that's made into the market today, it's very scary. And it's very, very, very potent and deadly.
Again, we're talking with Mark Thornton. He is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in beautiful Auburn, Alabama, and he's a bit of an expert on these things, having written and talked about the drug war. Well, I got a couple of things, and the one thing is that I think what you're arguing for is that if we allow these drugs to become legal, we will get purer drugs, not dirtier drugs. Therefore, we won't have some of the problems that we have. But having said that, if you allow these drugs, then are you going to also say, as a libertarian, that we need to have the government regulate these drugs? Or are we just going to allow an open market, let the drugs come and go as they will, let them develop as they will, do not regulate them, allow adults to make decisions, rightly or wrongly? I mean, where do you stand with the government in any way with drug legalization?
Paul, I think that the marketplace would be dramatically improved without the government involved at all. But I'm more than happy to have the government involved if it will just lay down its sword and end the war on drugs. If that's what it takes to stop the killing, to stop the jailing, to stop the innocent deaths that are occurring in the United States on the Mexican border and throughout South America, Afghanistan, Turkey, and so forth, you know, I'd be willing to compromise. But believe me, from what I've been able to see, the marketplace can create a safe environment. You know, Walmart is not going to sell dangerous drugs. It's not going to sell drugs to kids. It's got a reputation. It's afraid of lawsuits. And so if we make this thing corporate, it's going to be a lot safer. And it's going to take the violence. It's going to take all the unintended consequences off of the table. There's going to be, in my opinion, less harm overall, and that the market will, as it does in other areas, make create a process of continual improvement with respect to these products and their uses, and also make them available for their non-recreational uses, you know, for doctors and hospitals and pharmaceutical companies and people who suffer from a variety of illnesses. These products have legitimate uses, some of which we're just now finding out about. This past year, we just found out that a non-recreational component of marijuana actually cures epileptic seizures in children, making life really possible for them for the very first time. So I think the market is a remarkable mechanism, and that we'll get actually more progress if we don't bring the government in to regulate these products.
Very eloquently said, Mark Thornton. I've got one final question, and that is, do you believe, and again as a libertarian, do you believe and see the legalization of drugs, say, in the United States as a source of revenue for the government, the taxing of it? I mean, an incentive to increase funding of the government itself?
Yeah, it works. It works both ways, actually. For example, the city of Philadelphia decided to not prosecute marijuana consumers. They saved $2 million in court costs in the first year. So it reduces their costs. But you can also look at places like in California where they tax marijuana. It becomes a source of revenue. And, you know, that's one of the major reasons why alcohol was re-legalized, is because, you know, prior to 1920, alcohol was one of the major sources of revenue for the federal, state, county, and local governments. Prohibition ended that stream of income. And in 1932 and 1933, local, county, state, federal governments, they couldn't pay for the salaries of their employees. They couldn't keep schools opened. And so the legalization of alcohol actually reopened those revenue sources. And so that was sort of the carrot with respect to getting, you know, the avalanche of positive support for repealing alcohol prohibition was that it helped consumers, it helped created jobs, and it created tax revenue. So it was a win-win-win proposition. And, you know, as the Times said, happy days are here again. You know, that was Roosevelt's theme song in 1932. It was America's favorite song in the early 1930s. And it's still the Democratic Party theme song as well. So I think that drug legalization is a win-win-win proposition for consumers, for jobs, for health, and actually for government revenue. And that's not one of my favorite reasons, but, you know, we've got local, county, state, and federal governments all running budget deficits and having to cut budget expenditure. So that's part of the equation politically, but it's not the real story here. The real story is health for Americans, reduction of violence, you know, stop the arresting of nonviolent people, throwing them in prison, ruining their lives, giving them a criminal history. That's where the win-win-win proposition really is for legalizing drugs.
Well, Mark, again, you've made a very eloquent case. And if people want to find out more about your what you you know, what you're all about there at the Von Mises Institute, and maybe even about some of the things that you've written about regarding drugs, what is the best way for them to access that?
Our web page is one of the largest economic web pages in the world, and it's there for real people. It's mises.org, and you can search in the search box for my name or drug legalization or prohibition. You'll find tons of stuff that I've written, and that we've got hundreds of scholars that contribute to our daily articles and in our great conferences. We've got the Austrian Economic Research Conference coming up in March, and we've got Judge Napolitano coming to James Grant is going to be here. This is going to be the best Austrian Economic Research Conference we've ever had, and I think it's a sign that so many people are coming to Austrian Economics, and the New York Times and the Washington Post are attacking us just in the last couple of weeks. So,
well, you must be doing something right if they're both attacking you.
Yes, I think we are doing something right, and that's why I encourage all of your listeners to check out Mises.org.
And what's the date again of that conference?
It's coming up in mid-March.
Mid-March. All right. So they can go to the Von Mises website, Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. They can find out more about that conference as well.
Under our events tab, yes.
Sounds good, Mark. Again, a real delight to have you on, as always, and I look forward to our next chat. So take good care, my friend.
Thank you, Paul. Enjoyed it.
Okay. Mark Thornton. Wow. I tell you what, he really knows his stuff. I mean, I threw questions at him. I thought that were pretty tough, but I thought he counterpunched very, very, very well, and I wanted to play devil's advocate. Anyway, going to take a short break here on Freedom Works, and we'll be back just a short time, so don't go away, please.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8.
I'm starving.
She loves the theater, but she never comes late.
I never bother. That's why this chick is a tramp.
Good Friday morning. This is Pryor Smith speaking from Toronto. Topping the news from back home for vacationing Canadians, a major snow, rain, and windstorm is moving through the Maritimes in Newfoundland. Canada's men's hockey team opens the Olympic tournament with a win over Norway, but it wasn't a cakewalk as many had expected. They're playing Austria today. All of those stories and more, please join me for Canada Calling. For 60 years, a daily update of Canadian news.
Life fans, the biggest MMA event in the history of Wesley Chapel takes place Saturday, February 15th, 6 p.m. at Freedom High School. Wesley Chapel Fight Night 5 features 10 amateur bouts and 6 female bouts. Tickets available and can be purchased online at AOLMMA.com or the Wesley Chapel Wing House. For VIP information, call 813-992-2886. Wesley Chapel Fight Night 5. Be there.
It's here, but only for a few more days. The 110th Florida State Fair, the first place for fun, and with more than 110 free things to see and do every day. More than 110 rides, more roller coasters, and more armband days. More free concerts and more food and exhibits than ever before. For the fair lineup and for ticket information, go to floridastatefair.com. Don't miss the Florida State Fair. It closes Monday, February 17th.
You're listening to the Tan Talk Radio Network.
What can I lose? 'Cause I got no dough.
Oh, no?
I'm alone when I lower my lamp.
That's why the lady is a champ.
Go. Thank you, Tony. It's Valentine's Day. We thought we'd do a little bit of Tony Bennett. You know, he's one of those, it's like Frank Sinatra. He's got all the beautiful songs, you know, the romantic songs, and he's still performing. I was reading about him, I think, in the St. Pete Times. I wouldn't say he's going strong. I've heard that his voice, you know, after all these years, has gotten a little bit weaker. But he's still going, and I tell you what, he's pushing 90 if he's not there already. Anyway, we're going to be giving you the top 10 best colleges in America in just a few minutes, so please stick around for that. In the meantime, though, the lovely and talented and charming leader of North Korea is making news again. North Korea's efforts to build a cyber army that can conduct a string of attacks on neighboring states has some experts starting to ask some questions. Is North Korea gearing up for a cyber assault on America? And does it have the capability? Now, a visiting scholar at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins says they do have the capability, but I don't think that they have the intention. But a lot of people are not so sure about that, and you would think the way that this guy is acting, and maybe it's more reacting, because I don't know if there's a lot of intellectual thought behind it. But not everybody is so unsure about what North Korea is trying to do. Like the Cold War in the 50s and in the 60s, cyber warfare is becoming an arms race. Many nations, including the U.S., are building up their offensive and defensive capabilities amid an increase of espionage and a proliferation of attacks on both public and private computer networks. I wonder if the day is coming, and Lee, you're a bit of an expert on the internet. Do you think that there may be in the near future such a vicious attack perhaps launched by some country or somebody that it might indeed bring down most of the internet, as it were? Do you think that could occur or will occur?
I think it definitely could occur. Uh-huh. It's incredibly vulnerable. You ever hear about these EMP blasts that they talk about?
I'm not sure I know what that is.
Electromagnetic pulse.
Okay.
Like if one of these things went off, above the United States, you know, they say it could fry all the electronics.
Oh, really?
Within a given area, yeah.
That they could do something that could actually ruin...
It could fry the computers, amazing. Take down the network. It's extremely vulnerable, extremely, tentative, delicate.
Fragile and...
Fragile.
Yeah. It's something that you feel could occur very...
sure.
Because, I read also about this electric grid thing.
Yeah.
Boy, that is scary. You can shut down the entire... Yeah.
Coming out of
the entire electricity of an area like L.A., Los Angeles.
Sure. No more power. I mean...
How...
We're like...
Devastating. We couldn't even comprehend how devastating that could be. I mean, it's just... It's very scary when you think about it.
Business would just come to a grinding...
Yeah.
Halt.
And I wonder if it would be done by a country or just by some nutty genius types... arch villain genius types, you know, sitting somewhere in Eastern Europe or, middle of Africa.
I will bring down electronic grid.
Yeah.
Unless you pay me the sum of
$1 million.
It sounds like,
you know, Dr. Evil.
Dr. Evil or Dr. No. Evil I was thing. Just watching Dr. No. Remember the beautiful, the first James Bond movie, Dr. No?
Sure.
And that guy, he had demanded all kinds of money from both, this is made in 62, middle of the Cold War, and he had demanded all kinds of money from both Russia and the United States, or he was going to wreck the whole missile system. And of course, they both told him to go scratch. And but, you know, there you go. I mean, you could extortion or whatever else. It just
or just for fun and profit,
fun and games.
Well, fun and profit.
Yeah,
they should have given him offered him Ursula Andress, right? I mean, that would have been a fair trade.
He tried to get Dr. No tried to get his mitts on Ursula Andress. One problem, if you remember, Dr. No, is he had to wear these gloves because he had ruined his hands with radioactivity, and that
I have the same problem, Paul.
Yeah, I know you wear those big black gloves like Dr. No. I always did wonder why you wore them.
I have a Michael Jackson fetish.
Anyway, I think we got off the topic a little bit, but it is very it's disconcerting, and I don't know how you can stop somebody. All you need is a certain code, it seems like, and you can get into these systems and have them self destruct or do whatever you want, and we become
and
so reliant.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Go ahead.
The internet's very vulnerable to a cyber attack, to a hack attack as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a bunch of real smart Chinese guys or Russians. They're really brilliant programmers on the case, and they can figure it out.
There certainly could be a lot of movies made about, like, from afar, remote controlling things, and the fact that you could make these systems destruct different countries that the systems are in, you know, like self-destruct. I mean, you could really make some great movies. I mean, you can go anywhere with movies, and some of that
I think there are a lot of them out there, a lot of movies maybe we haven't.
Oh, yeah.
Necessarily seen them, or but
yeah, it's
about that very thing. Yeah,
well,
the whole deal, Paul. Mm-hmm. The whole system is just very tentative. That's the word I was like. It's very tentative.
Yes,
you know, I mean, all this stuff could come crashing down pretty quick.
Boy, oh boy, just it's almost like a house of stilts or cards, huh?
I think so.
You think?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And you may be right about that too. Well, to an entirely different topic here. Have you ever heard of the American Humanist Association? Well, I've heard of them. They're now advocating that messages to a school in Minnesota accusing, or let me put it this way, the American Humanist Association has sent a message to a school in Minnesota saying that the kids should stop feeding starving children or else. Now that sounds pretty mean-spirited, but the AHA accuses the kids of violating the U.S. Constitution by allowing students to participate in a community service project at a church. They don't think that the church should be the place where these things are done. Now, they got their britches in a bunch, the American Humanists, after the family of a student at the School of Engineering and Arts in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, objected to the project being held at the local Calvary Lutheran Church. And here is a lawyer for the humanists. The school has clearly violated the establishment clause by sending public school children under your authority, meaning that school, to a religious environment, to work with religious organizations that are on a religious mission. And it is a violation of the First Amendment principle of church-state separation. Well, when I read that, I thought, well, it's actually the other way around. The government is to allow anybody access to any religious affiliation, not try to stop them from a religious affiliation. And so I often wonder when people bring these things up, whether they're not stifling religion rather than allowing all religion. It's a very, I guess you go, you know, you can make a good argument for both. But you know, to take it down to kids that were preparing things for, this was all to do with preparing meals for impoverished children in Haiti. And we're letting all of this happen while these poor kids in Haiti need the food. I don't know about that. Also, I used to work at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, so I saw this little story. The current chairman, or I should say chief executive officer of the chamber, his name's Tom Donahue, is now saying that the U.S. needs more low-skilled immigration because Americans are not qualified or are not willing to do that kind of work. So the chamber is kind of an open border, taking an open border philosophy, which in some ways is good for business. And you got to remember that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce represents businesses. But they're also a conservative organization as well. And I guess in many ways, a lot of their members are not so excited about the open border philosophy. But here's, again, Tom Donahue, the CEO at the chamber. Immigration can also address labor shortages in lesser skilled fields where there are insufficient numbers of either qualified or willing U.S. workers to fill positions. Now, Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican, Alabama, frames it differently. He says we must transition struggling Americans from welfare and joblessness to work and rising wages. But the only plan the president and the Senate Democrats appear interested in would hollow out a shrinking American middle class. So Sessions says it's time to redefine immigration reform to serve the legitimate interests of working Americans. Well, we got, what, about 5 minutes, Lee? And it's time for us to get to our top 10 best colleges in the United States. Do we have our drummer ready to go here? Is Tony Bennett's drummer ready? And why in the heck?
He's union, you know.
Yeah, and yeah. Why in the heck would Tony Bennett need a drummer? I can't think of any song he sang where he had a lot of harsh drumming in the background, but we do need a drummer for our top 10 best colleges in America. Now, this is according to U.S. News and World Report, and the ranking came out in August of this past year. So, without further ado, number 10, Dartmouth College, New Hampshire.
My uncle is a graduate of
Dartmouth. Is he really?
Yes.
Well, he's went to a wonderful school, and he must be very, very intelligent.
He's really smart.
Yeah?
He's really smart.
That's where you maybe get some of your intelligence?
I don't know. I don't think since he's my uncle, I don't think I
got. Oh, yeah, I think you can claim some. Maybe, there's a genetic pool there. You know that.
Yeah. He was the head of the language department at Wesleyan University.
Wesleyan University?
Something. I think he became head of, like, a lot of stuff.
So he graduated from Dartmouth with an English background.
He translates books into German and German books into English. Yeah.
Is he still doing this?
I think he's kind of retired. I don't know what he's up to these days. Mm-hmm. I'll have to give him a call and find out.
Would you please?
We're out of time now.
Call him now.
Tomorrow, let's do number 9.
Actually, we have a tie. This is also number 10. And here we go with drum roll. The California Institute of Technology.
Great.
So Dartmouth and the California Institute of Technology are tied. I wanted to also say...
Caltech. Is that what they call Caltech?
I don't know if it's Cal...
No, not Caltech.
Is it? California Institute of Tech? Caltech.
I'm probably full of it.
No, no. I think you might be right. Caltech. That sounds right. Caltech. Yes. I would say you're right. I also wanted to give you the enrollment, though, and the tuition, in case anybody listening wants to go. If you want to go to Dartmouth, first of all, you will be among 4,193 undergraduates, and you will pay $46,752 annual tuition and fees. So about $47,000 tuition and fees. If you want to go to Caltech.
Can you get a fast food job after you?
You will need. You will need not only a fast food job, you'll need a slow food job and a medium food job, just because it's going to be very expensive to afford your lifestyle.
You need to have a fast food franchise too.
I think so.
Pay for that.
That'll be it. At Caltech, they have an enrollment of. Wait till you hear this. 997 undergraduates. That's all. California Institute of Technology, 997. That doesn't sound right. And the fee, $42,000. Number seven, University of Pennsylvania. They are tied with, also on number seven, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Both tied for number seven. And about 10,000 people go to Penn, and about 4,500 people go to MIT. Number seven, also Duke University. Duke has a total undergraduate enrollment of about 6,600. The fee, about $45,000 a year, tuition and fee. Number five, University of Chicago. They've got about 6,000 undergrads, and they tuition and fees, about $46,000. Number five.
My sister got her business degree there.
At University of Chicago?
MBA. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. It's a great school.
Yeah. She was a big Friedman guy. So you.
Oh, Milton was there. Milton was there. That's one of the reasons. And he also was at the next school, Milton Friedman. A tie with number five, Stanford University. Stanford University, total undergrads, 7,063. Annual tuition and fees, about $43,000. Number three. Where's the drums?
That's anticlimactic.
Number three is Columbia University in New York. Columbia University, total undergrads, 6,000. And go ahead.
You're going to the next. You know an interesting thing about Columbia?
What?
Supposedly Obama was editor of the Law Review.
Okay.
And stuff.
Yep.
But you know, strangely enough, and there are people in media and everything, nobody remembers ever seeing him at Columbia.
Yeah, I've heard that.
There's not one person who can.
I think he was very introverted, maybe. He just stayed in his apartment all the time. I don't know.
Well, it's pretty good for editing the Law Review.
I guess. Yeah. It certainly is. Anyway, number four was Columbia. Number three is Yale. Yale University, Connecticut. Total undergrads, 5,405. Tuition and fees, 44,000. Number two, Harvard University. Harvard, total undergrads, 6,600. And tuition and fees, about $43,000. And number one, top college in America is Princeton. And it's got 5,300 kids and annual tuition and fees of $40,000. Now you know everything you need to know. Thanks for being with us. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you Tuesday.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.